From Jefferson Public Radio at Southern Oregon University, this is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Coming up after the news, the other end of the pipe that receives our waste products. There's no nice way to say sewage and human waste, so there you are. But the story does not end with us flushing the toilet, because there's no such place as away. In Arcata, a series of wetlands help in treating sewage, and they are places people want to visit. In the Eugene-Springfield area, so-called biosolids help trees grow strong and healthy. You'll meet the people who keep these operations running and hear what it took to get them started in the first place. Could any community do this? We'll ask. Arcata Marsh, Eugene's Biocycle Farm, and your phone calls and emails ahead in the coming hour of the Jefferson Exchange. First, though, we'll check in on the latest in the news of the hour. This is the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. We broadcast live weekday mornings and rebroadcast weekday evenings on radio stations serving Oregon and California. And we are found online at jeffexchange.org. Click Listen Live at that site, and you can listen to the program through the Internet pretty much anywhere in the world. It is Wednesday, September 11th, 2013. I'm Jeffrey Riley, and I'm glad you're along for the ride today. In this hour, creative uses for our waste products. We'll talk about the Arcata Marsh and how it helps filter wastewater. And you'll hear how Biocycle Farm in the Eugene area makes use of what we call biosolids. You can join our discussion on the exchange. You'll hear phone numbers and email address shortly. First, a weather forecast from Jefferson Exchange producer Charlotte Duran.
On the Northern California coast today, increased threat of sneaker waves, areas of fog and cloudy with a high near 61. In Redding and Red Bluff, sunny with a high near 95. In Yreka, sunny and hot with a high near 96. In Weed and Mount Shasta, sunny with a high near 90. On the Southern Oregon coast, areas of fog and mostly cloudy with a high near 65. In the Klamath Basin, sunny with a high near 88. In Grants Pass, Medford, and Ashland, sunny and hot with a high near 100. On the Southern Oregon Cascades and Siskiyous, sunny with a high near 82. In Roseburg and the Umpqua Basin, sunny with a high near 93. And in Eugene and Springfield today, sunny with a high near 89.
Continued hot, continued dry around the region. Humidity is very, very low, which is why the Clover Fire in the south end of Shasta County was able to get as big as it did, as fast as it did. It is now listed at 7,012 acres, 40% contained. Was it 30 fires have already been, 30 homes already destroyed by the fire? There are still some 300 structures threatened, but there seems to be a greater degree of confidence that the firefighters will get a handle on this. They did slow the growth of the fire yesterday again, 40% containment. And Happy Valley Schools did open again today in the south end of Shasta County. There was some smoke on the horizon on the Oregon side yesterday as well. Burnout activity still going on the fires that started back on July 26th in that lightning storm. So still issues with fires around the region, still very dry. And the hot weather will continue for a couple of days. 80 structures now considered destroyed by the Clover Fire, not all of them homes. Just wanted to give you an update on that figure. Thank you for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to join us on the exchange, here's how. Call us anywhere in the listening area at 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Out of sight, out of mind, the saying goes, and it is very true of human waste. Once we flush the toilet, most of us stop thinking about what we just sent away. The problem is there's no such place as away. Our waste products do not leave the planet. In fact, they generally don't leave town. But over the years, new methods for handling human wastes have emerged, and we'll focus on a couple of them here today. The Arcata Marsh and Wildlife Sanctuary is part of the wastewater treatment process in Arcata. And the Biocycle Farm in the Eugene area makes use of what people in the business call biosolids. We have a couple of guests with us here today. Dave Couch is a wastewater operator with Arcata. Dave, thanks for joining us. Dave, you there?
Nice to be here.
Yep, gotcha. Okay. And with the Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission, NWMC, in the Eugene-Springfield area, we have with us Todd Miller, an environmental management analyst. Todd, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So let's talk about your specific areas in some detail here. Dave Couch, let's start with you. When did the city create the marsh, and did it have any template to follow it? Anything like that been done before then?
Well, the marsh was part of an upgrade to comply with the Clean Water Act. And so it actually went online in 1986. But prior to that, we kind of went through a long process of, you know, what we needed to do to comply with the updated regulations of the Clean Water Act of 1972. And so the marsh concept kind of came from engineering professors at HSU. And they had this idea that we could add, we like to call them constructed wetlands rather than marsh. And so adding constructed wetlands is another level of treatment after our existing treatment plant, and that would be a cost-effective way to deal with the Clean Water Act. And we had quite a battle with the state and federal government because the Clean Water Act, besides being a regulatory act, was a funding act. And so the way they liked to work the Clean Water Act was to build regional treatment plants. And so what Arcata wanted to do by just keeping our existing treatment plant and upgrading it kind of killed the regional treatment plant for the Humboldt Bay area.
They would have wanted Eureka, Arcata, all those communities in together?
Right. They were going to, I mean, there was going to be the Humboldt Bay Wastewater Authority, and so there was going to be one giant treatment plant that would serve like Eureka, Arcata, and McKinleyville, and then have an ocean discharge. And that was not favorably looked on by the Arcata City Council because we would have this pipeline going several miles around the north side of Humboldt Bay out to the site of the new treatment plant. And once you build a pipeline like that, it allows people to tie into it. So it would have opened all of our agricultural lands to real estate development, and they wanted to try to maintain the agriculture lands as agriculture land. So that was, you know, one of the big reasons they didn't like the big project. And so we kind of had to battle with the state and the feds over what we wanted to do with our project, but eventually we were able to get a permit to go forward with it.
When you say constructed wetlands, what was there before the Arcata wetlands existed?
Well, let me give you kind of a quick history of our treatment plant, and that'll explain everything. So up until 1949, Arcata just had a straight pipe coming into the bay, no treatment. That was kind of the norm back then.
Really, just straight and, out?
Yeah, and so that was when they started growing oysters in Humboldt Bay. And the first batch of oysters grown in Humboldt Bay and shipped down to the San Francisco Bay Area caused an outbreak of gastrointestinal diseases. And, you know, you can't really grow oysters in an area that's contaminated with raw sewage. So State Fish and Game asked the city of Arcata to build a treatment plant. So back then a primary treatment plant was built. And then that was upgraded in the mid-1950s to a secondary treatment by building an oxidation pond after the primary treatment, and then chlorine disinfection was added after that. So that's kind of the way it was until from mid-1950s until we needed to meet the Clean Water Act requirements, which the Clean Water Act came out in 1972, and all the promulgations of it kind of went on through the 70s and 80s. And basically our oxidation pond couldn't always meet a water quality called total suspended solids because we had a lot of algae in the effluent. So the idea behind the constructed wetlands was to simply use a natural system to filter out the algae solids out of the oxidation pond effluent. And our oxidation pond, when it was built in the 1950s, they just brought in a dredge and diked off a big portion of Humboldt Bay. So, you know, I always tell people that wouldn't happen in today's environmental regulation. You know, we wouldn't convert the bay into oxidation ponds. So that happened back in the mid-1950s. And then we had another area, like west of us, that had been a landfill for years and years next to the bay. And so as part of restoring it, we capped the landfill, and then we built constructed wetlands around it. And we like, you know, constructed wetlands, it's just you can't use a natural wetland for wastewater treatment, but if you build a wetland, then you can use it. So that's why we like to call them constructed wetlands.
So are they very, very different from what a natural wetland would be like that in that area?
Well, the area would all be salt marsh probably, and so we have freshwater wetlands And we kind of manage them mm-hmm. based on either wildlife habitat values or water quality values. And so when we plant them, we plant them with plants that we've determined are good for water quality treatment.
All right, much more to talk about with, I have to pick it up here on the other side of a break. Dave Couch is our guest. He's a wastewater operator with the City of Arcata. We're talking about the Arcata Marsh area. We're also talking to Todd Miller at the Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission in the Eugene Springfield area about the BioCycle Farm. Much more to talk about here on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll return and take your phone calls and emails for Dave and Todd when we return to the Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today about creative uses for human waste with Dave Couch, a wastewater operator for the City of Arcata. Todd Miller is the Environmental Management Analyst in Eugene for the Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission, Eugene Springfield, I should say. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about BioCycle Farm and Arcata Marsh, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 800-838-3760. Wait, did I get that right? Okay, this is what happens when you begin to do things automatically. It's 800-838-3760 anywhere. In the Rogue Valley, it's 541-552-6782. And our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Dave, I think I stopped you a little short there, but you were talking about the fact that these are constructed wetlands, and so they are fresh water where you'd normally have salt marsh in that area. I guess salt marsh would not have done the job that you're looking for in doing some filtering?
No. Just because, well, there's problems if you mix salt water in with the wastewater flow. And so basically, you know, we treat the wastewater, you know, before we discharge it into the marine environment. So that's kind of our goal there.
All right. Let's turn things over to Todd Miller now, the Environmental Management Analyst at Kuwait. What? Who? What? Okay, let's try again. Todd Miller, Environmental Management Analyst with Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission. Can you give us a little thumbnail sketch of the things that you do at the NWMC to make creative uses of human waste?
Sure, Jeffrey. NWMC has been pretty innovative in looking at the end product of wastewater treatment and trying to make it as sustainable as possible. Been pretty innovative for a long time. Much like Arcata, the history of wastewater treatment in Eugene Springfield sprung out of the early part of the 20th century when the Willamette River was deemed an open sewer by some concerns, and we started installing wastewater treatment processes. Eugene and Springfield combined in the late 1970s, by early 1980s, we had the combined treatment plant up and running, and that was really a result of the Clean Water Act requirements and some federal initiatives. And at that time, the MWMC, which is the commission that operates all of the treatment plant, it's a partnership between Eugene and Springfield, but the commission oversees the entire operation for the metropolitan area, invested in some agricultural lands to reuse some cannery waste that would have overburdened the local treatment plant and but didn't have the same treatment requirements and needs that that the raw sewage from the local community would. And so there's a lagoon and agricultural lands where the cannery waste, this is like vegetable cannery waste, would go out and then they would irrigate a cropland, grasslands, and ultimately produce grass seed primarily. And then in the late 1990s, with the involvement of a citizen advisory committee, that group and the MWMC recommended that Eugene Springfield move ahead with a diversification of its biosolids program. So the biosolids are the nutrient-rich organic solid residual that comes out of the wastewater treatment process. By and large, the great majority of what flows into a treatment plant is water. But the solid constituent is removed fairly early in the process and goes to anaerobic digesters. That's what produces methane, and those are rising in popularity both in agricultural operations as well as municipal operations for harnessing that methane that's produced and turning that into energy. MWMC's been producing their own electricity from that methane byproduct since the early 1980s as well. And the solids that result from that digestion process, which is step one in the treatment.
Digestion by bacteria, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, bacteria, right. So anaerobic means without oxygen. So depending on the process in the treatment train, wastewater treatment really is a big biomimicker of what happens in the natural environment, but at a much concentrated and larger scale, both in time and mass and volume. So bacteria are our friends, and so for the solids, the anaerobic digesters, the bacteria that digest and break down those solids under those anaerobic conditions are our number one agent in treating the original solids that come off of there. From there, that material is further processed into what, as you mentioned, the industry terms biosolids. Different than sludge. Sludge is just the that solid material that comes in basically in the raw sewage and is separated out. After it's treated, it becomes biosolids, which is a product that is reduced in pathogens and really concentrates. It's like a compost product, and it's nutrient-rich and has been applied to local farm fields under, excuse me, in cooperation with some local grass seed farmers and others in the area. What happened in the 1990s with that Citizen Advisory Committee, they wanted to know, is our program sustainable? Will we be able to continue to use these biosolids and have the farm base to continue to use those? And looking at that, they decided that an investment of the MWMC into their own agricultural facility, raising poplar trees, would be the ticket. And so we have a 600-acre piece of property that was acquired. And starting in 2003, the first poplars were planted. And we've got three phases, so three rotations of different age classes of poplars that are grown on about 400 acres of that farm. And the purpose there is twofold. One, it diversifies our biosolids program. So one, we always have a land base between the local farmers and our own operations to continue to utilize 100% of our biosolids. And it also gives us some flexibility in the treatment. Our volumes ebb and flow over the course of a year, so the amount of biosolids produced are within a range. That ensures that we've got capability to put those biosolids in a place where they'd be put to good use, and poplar trees are very well adapted to their nutrient uptake is very significant. It's about three times that of what a grass seed crop would be. And they readily take up water, too. So we also reuse water, recycle water from the plant to irrigate those trees.
And
the final piece of that, I just want to add, Jeffrey, the final piece of that is now we're excited because we're in our first harvest. Our oldest trees are now 10 years old, and so we're talking about reusing the poplar that's grown from this operation and trying to find the highest end use that we can for those.
And what are some of the uses of poplar trees? And we're talking, well, the original planting was something like 35,000 tree starts, wasn't it?
I believe that's just about correct. Let me see. 35,000 is correct in that first phase, which was 156 acres. So it's a density of 222 trees per acre. When the poplar farm was first invested in, consultants that were doing these types of projects for other municipalities and farmers were really touting the up-and-coming sawlog market, and that was deemed to be the poplar was going to be a fairly attractive alternative sustainable wood crop. And poplar is indeed readily used for sawlog purposes and things like pallets, shipping crates, boxes, trim work and moldings. Poplar is very well suited for that. It's a very fast-growing hardwood, so it has some kind of softwood properties to it, but it doesn't have very good structural integrity, so it's not used for things like 2x4s. But what's happened over the last 10 years is that those markets have not really matured or taken off in the direction that we're foreseen. But luckily, poplar is used for many other things. It was initially hybridized and grown for the paper pulp industry, and that's still a demand. Wood chips, which is the bulk of where our current harvest is going, the product is chipped and then sent off to mills in the regional area, as far away as Longview, Washington, I believe. Our contractor is sending some of our chips right now from the Eugene-Springfield area, and then much closer to town. I'm not exactly positive what they do with those, but they make some kind of fiber engineered wood products out of those chips, fiber boards and things like that.
All right, but they're not traveling terribly far, just a couple of hours, it sounds like.
Yeah, right. And the economics of transportation and where those chips go, it's very geographically constrained. And a group of us just on Monday went out and toured a few sites and learning more about the use of poplar for biofuels. Biofuels can be both in the form of just wood product that's incinerated. So we have a local wood products company that actually generates electricity for the local grid by burning forest residuals that would have otherwise just been burned off and slashed in the fields. And they could be interested in some of our poplar material in the future, producing electricity from it. There's also groups now based at a federal and regional level looking very hard at growing poplar because of their growing characteristics and their chemistry is readily suited for producing ethanol-type biofuels out of them. And so we're pretty excited about all the different really, you know, positive end products that can come out of this operation.
This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio. We're talking about creative uses for human waste. Todd Miller is the Environmental Management Analyst at the Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission in the Eugene-Springfield area. We're talking generally about BioCycle Farm and the use of biosolids out of the wastewater stream in the Eugene area. Dave Couch is with us as well, a wastewater operator in Arcata, and we're talking about the Arcata Marsh and Wildlife area. And you can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we continue our discussion, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, email address jx@jeffnet.org. Grumpy John in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, Jeffrey and gentlemen. My neighboring farmer put some sewage sludge on his field supplied by the county, Josephine County. I don't know the exact source of it, but let me tell you, it was one of the most noxious, enduring, gaggalacious experiences that I have experienced in the entire state of Oregon, and in fact, probably the United States. It was just disgusting, and I don't know what went wrong with their plan or where it came from, but boy, I wouldn't want it within 50 miles of me, any noses, or any drinking water.
All right. Thanks for the story. Let's follow up with this because, Todd, there was an issue a couple of years ago, I remember, in Cottage Grove where some of the biosolids had been applied to some farmer's field, and it was smellier than anybody really expected.
Yeah, that's true. The MWMC is pretty fortunate. We have a real state-of-the-art operation, and we actually have no odor complaints. We have a really strong relationship with our neighbors. And matter of fact, I was just giving a radio interview last week, and we were strolling around the farm, and the interviewer asked, "Why doesn't it smell?" And it's because our operations are so good. We've got real state-of-the-art equipment and have the processes dialed down that our biosolids product, once it's put out in the field, if you're there while it's being applied, you'll notice a little bit of a smell. It's kind of like maybe like a healthy stream bottom. You know, you can definitely tell that it's got some more organic constituent to it, so it's not completely odorless, but it's not like the sludge type of smell by any means. And Grumpy John, I think we had the pleasure of having you on when I was on about a year ago when we were talking about the up on this radio show. And I remember that same comment coming up. And I can't comment on that operation and why it was different, but I can just say that the MWMC's operations have been very well received, and we've got strong neighbor support and no odor complaints.
And Dave Couch in Arcata, we haven't really discussed what happens with the biosolids in your operation going through the Arcata Marsh, these constructed wetlands. So what does happen to biosolids in your operation?
Well, our primary treatment takes out the biosolids before it goes to the marsh, so the marsh really isn't involved with the biosolids part of it. But we have anaerobic digestion, too, which is comparable to probably what they do in Eugene. And then we, after composting, or well, after digestion, we do what we call aerobic composting of the sludge, where we mix the biosolids, I shouldn't say sludge, and so we mix the biosolids with green waste and wood chips, and then we aerobically compost that, and during that process, it basically eliminates the odor and disinfects the stuff. So we produce what we call, there's different ratings for biosolids, and basically we produce a Class A exceptional quality biosolid, which is the highest degree of biosolid, and we're able to use that as a soil amendment comparable to what they do up there, but we don't have a tree farm to use it on, but we're, you know, a much smaller city than the Eugene-Springfield area,
sure.
And we've been in the process of acquiring natural resource lands kind of around the bay that we leased to farmers to run cattle on. And then in the wintertime, we have a big population of Aleutian cackling geese that come here in winter, and they feed on the grass in the fields too. So there's always been a conflict between our leasee ranchers who want the grass for their cows and our population of migrating Aleutian geese that need the grass to eat while they're here. And so we put our biosolids out in those fields and supplement the nutrients in the field, so we get good production of grass both for the cattle and the geese.
There are limits, aren't there, Dave, I mean, to what biosolids can be used for? I mean, you can't use biosolids in any application where you're growing food for human consumption, correct?
Well, the regulation is that you can't use it and consider it organic. So our Class A exceptional quality biosolid you could use for food crops, because Class A means we've actually tested for most common chemical compounds that might be in the waste, and then it's been disinfected. So you could use it as a soil amendment for crops, but then they wouldn't pass the organic regulations. So most people around here are trying to go for the organic production. So you know, isn't a popular thing for food production here, but in some places they do use it for food production, and there's different, you know, when I say Class A exceptional quality, maybe Todd could talk about, you know, I'm sure that's probably what they do too, but there's like Class A through Class D, and D means it's a toxic waste, like the sewer sludge that comes out of the Los Angeles area is considered a toxic waste, and it goes to a special disposal site in the Central Valley, and you know, that's a different issue, but we try to, you know, have the highest degree of treatment of our solids, and then with a Class A exceptional quality, we theoretically, according to the federal government, we wouldn't have to keep a paper trail of where they go because they've passed these criteria. But our California Water Quality Control Board makes us keep a record of, you know, where we dispose of our solid waste. So we do that.
Todd Miller, what is the process that turns sludge into biosolids?
Well, it's really the removal of the reduction of the pathogens in the material. And
what
that
kinds
original
of pathogens?
Well, you know, you can imagine both human waste and then the other types of food waste and fats and greases and things that accumulate in the system and harbor those types of bacteria and that can be can affect the human. So, you know, E. coli is probably one of the most commonly known. Certain strains of that cause severe human illness, the gastrointestinal illnesses that Dave had mentioned. And what happens is, under the anaerobic processes and the heat that's generated during the kind of the composting process that happens, it kills off those pathogens to a point where they're safe for handling for putting on a field.
All right, much more to talk about with Todd Miller in Eugene and Dave Couch in Arcata about creative uses for human waste. We'll come back and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about good uses for human waste, because it doesn't just go away when we flush the toilet. It has to go somewhere, and on the other end of the pipe, there are some things going on to make use of the products that we create. Dave Couch is with us. He's a wastewater operator in Arcata, and we're talking about the Arcata Marsh and Wildlife Sanctuary, another other uses for the wastewater in the Arcata area. At the Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission in Eugene, Springfield, we're talking to Todd Miller, who's the Environmental Management Analyst there. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Phone numbers 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We had a call and an email in this same basic realm, gentlemen. Lance in Ashland wanted to know what happens to the toxics and prescriptions that go down the sink. And Faya in Arcata wanted to know what happens to flushable wipes. What do these do in the waste stream, and how are they handled? Todd, let me have you take this one.
Okay, well, I'll address the wipes first. What we advocate is no wipes in the toilet. Nothing but toilet paper and your own waste goes down the toilet. Even the wipes that are advertised as being flushable and dissolvable, we're finding just tend to clog up the system. They can both clog up your domestic pipes coming right off of your house, as well as they get caught up in the treatment process. And if you ever have the pleasure of touring a wastewater treatment plant, which is actually pretty interesting, one of the most graphic parts of it is the original screening out of materials, and you'll see these wipes getting scraped out of the raw influent coming into the system. So what happens with materials like wipes and sticks and debris, plastics, other materials that don't degrade and would clog up the system in the treatment plant, those are all screened out in the very initial influent stage of the treatment plant, and that material is landfilled, where it really should have been disposed of in the first place rather than going down the toilet. Now I'll address the pharmaceutical constituents. That's been on everybody's radar for quite a while now. These so-called microconstituents or contaminants of emerging concern with improved methods of laboratory detection and better awareness of the prevalence of these different compounds and chemicals throughout our environment. We've become aware of these pharmaceuticals in the waste stream now. And what happens is a number of these products, pharmaceutical products, and things like also materials, chemicals that are in soaps and like triclosan, that's a antibacterial agent that's in those some of those antibacterial soaps. Those chemical compounds don't degrade. They're not really the same chemistry as what the treatment systems were designed to remove. So even though the system's not designed to necessarily remove those, they do reduce. Those compounds do break down considerably in the treatment train. A few of them are a little bit more recalcitrant, or I'm not sure what the word is. Don't break down as readily as the others. But we're finding is that the chemicals that we might be able to detect in wastewater, these very, very low, parts per trillion levels, one, are so low that there's studies that show, like, for example, the effluent from a wastewater treatment plant, you could drink a glass of that every day for 1,000 years before you got the equivalent of an aspirin. So that's the type of concentration that we're talking about. The main concern is that we want to keep these types of chemicals out of our aquatic systems, our rivers, and where the aquatic wildlife tend to be much more sensitive to these different chemicals, these endocrine disruptors and things like that can affect fish biology. And these types of compounds are not only coming through wastewater treatment plants, but just coming off of our urban areas. We're ensconced in these types of chemicals just every day when we're driving around in our cars and our airplanes, what we apply to ourselves in our showers. And so we actually do like the recycled water and the biosolids application, because put out on a terrestrial environment, those chemicals behave differently. They degrade more readily in the aerobic soil environment and aren't directly impacting the aquatic species.
So you're talking about gray water, I mean the reusage of that and the trapping of it and diverting it from the waste stream?
Well, I'm not talking specifically about gray water. When I'm mentioning recycling water, talking about the wastewater treatment plant, right now the water quality that we clean the water to where it's permitted for discharge to the Willamette River, that's a Class D recycled water product. So in Oregon, we've got four classes, much like the biosolids classes that Dave talked about, A, B, C, and D, where D is actually a clean product that's can be used that both meets the river discharge regulations, as well as it can be used on non-food crops like hay fields and the poplar farm, et cetera. We can clean that all the way up to a Class A product, which is filtered and gets additional chlorination or final treatment there, disinfection, and that water is actually suitable for just about everything except for drinking. You can irrigate your local playing fields with it, the local parks and schools and things like that, if we so desired to do that. So that's the product I'm talking about, as opposed to gray water specifically. That water might still contain some of these trace constituents in these parts per trillion type of levels that we're talking about. But you apply that to a terrestrial environment like on a grass field, and studies have shown that that material tends to basically disappear, just given the low concentrations and then the additional microbial action that's happening in that root zone soil interface.
All right, Dave Couch, I want to come back to not quite square one, but just to explore a little more about how things work at the Arcata Marsh and Wildlife Sanctuary. How many different levels of treatment are there within the marsh system, and what actually happens within those?
Well, first we have, once again, we have a typical primary treatment plant where we take the solids out, and then those go under their own treatment train, and that maybe takes, 60% of the strength of the wastewater out. Then after that, we use oxidation ponds for some of our secondary treatment. Then after our oxidation ponds, we have what we call treatment marshes, which are constructed wetlands that we primarily manage just for water quality criteria. And then after that, we have a series of what we call our enhancement marshes, which the water goes through, and we manage those for wildlife values, for open to the public, and it's a very popular area for people to come and bird watch and, see the water birds that use the marshes. And then after that, the water gets disinfected with chlorine, dechlorinated, and then is discharged into Humboldt Bay.
So does it leave the marsh system, go back to the plant for that final step or the final two steps of chlorination and dechlorination before it gets to the ocean?
Yes.
Okay.
And I wanted to address that previous question too about the flushable wipes and
sure, go ahead.
So anyway, I'm kind of a hands-on operator, and it's a real nightmare for us because one of the things the flushable wipes do is they tend to wind up turning into ropes and wrapping around impellers of pumps. And so for those of us who are hands-on guys, two or three times a week you have to go to various pump stations and basically open up the pumps and take those ropes of wipes off the impellers of pumps. And so that is a big problem for us. And it also can cause blockages in our sewage collection system. And then we have sewer overflows, which are, not a good thing. We get fined for that. So, it's really a good thing to tell people, to not flush those down the toilet. And the other thing on some of the different pharmaceuticals and stuff going down the drain. Well, there are programs now, where they talk about no drugs down the drain, where if you have a surplus of, pills, basically you don't want to flush them down the drain. You want to take them to a facility that accepts them and sends them off to a different waste stream rather than using the sewage system. But, of course, there's always going to be pass-through people. People use drugs, and then it passes through you. So there's always going to be some of that, going through the system. And we're currently doing a research project with a chemistry professor from HSU, Humboldt State University, and he's looking at what happens to caffeine as it goes through the system. And he's looking at caffeine because it's fairly easy to quantify, and there's a lot of it. You know, people right. drink a lot of coffee, and it goes through the system, so he's just using that as a tracer. And so one of the things that happens in our marshes is they kind of function as low-grade anaerobic reactors that have a long detention time, and they're actually pretty good at removing some of those trace chemicals. So,
what I think I hear you saying, Dave, is that the human body is not a particularly efficient filter, that we don't tend to filter. The stuff doesn't stay in our body if we're taking medications or drinking lots of coffee. That stuff will end up in the waste stream coming through us?
Yes.
Ah, learn something new every day.
Then it has to be treated.
Right. Todd Miller, talking about the relationship with between the city of Arcata and what it does at the Marsh and Humboldt State University, have you been able to use the brains of the University of Oregon much in developing systems at NWMC?
Yeah, you know, we do lots of partnerships on an annual basis with the University of Oregon. They're right here in our neighborhood. And also just up the road with Oregon State University in Corvallis, they have the Institute for Water and Watersheds up there. A lot of highly talented leaders in the field in water chemistry and looking at things like wetland treatment and the hyperreic flows, which is that near channel subsurface flow along river systems, and how important that is ecologically, as well as how that might relate to enhanced treatment performance for our waste stream. So, yeah, we definitely have good relationships with both of those institutions.
We heard from Dave about the issues with just trying to get the whole system set up the way it currently exists in Arcata. What kind of regulatory hoops did you have to go through with state and federal agencies to get the BioCycle Farm set up, for example? I mean, it sounds like you're breaking some new ground here that they didn't necessarily have a book on.
Yeah, and the implementation of the farm predates my involvement, so I don't know all of the hurdles and that were jumped over and hoops that were gone through to get there. I understand it was actually a pretty straightforward process. Number one, it's a biosolids application facility. So I think the biggest hurdle for us was that the MWMC invested in some land that was already agricultural land. It had been farmed in grass and hay operations for a century or at least decades previous to the MWMC acquiring the property. And so it was already an agricultural operation, and for the large part, there's some industrial zoning, but the vast majority of the farm is zoned for exclusive farm use. So a little bit different than California, but Oregon's land use rules are fairly strict, or I should say, I don't know how California's land use rules compare, but the types of operations you can have are pretty codified into and restricted in what you could do with the, depending on how it's zoned. So I know there was some debate and discussion originally whether it was an industrial operation or whether it was an agricultural operation, and the Land Use Board and the Department of Environmental Quality and the others that were involved determined that, yes, it is an agricultural operation, just like the biosolids that we export to other farms. That does not change that those farms are agricultural and that they are fertilizing with a fertilizer product, and so our operation also met that. On top of that, there's rules you need to follow for biosolids management and application on the land. You know, you want to avoid runoff, you want to avoid oversaturation and leaching nutrients down into the groundwater and over-nutrifying the aquifer. And the rules are pretty straightforward on that, and so the farm was just set up to follow all those restrictions and requirements.
About a minute left, and I want to ask each of you what happens in the future. I mean, now that you've actually gone, you're actually harvesting the poplars from the BioCycle Farm, is it likely to continue the same way? Are you going to keep doing the same thing, or will some adjustments be made in the future, do you think?
Well, that's plan A, is to continue the operation. What we're doing right now is we're doing some triple bottom line analysis on enhancing our recycled water use and increasing poplar growth, and we're going to be looking at the data we get from this initial harvest of the farm. And so we're going to keep, we always ask the question, we're doing great, can we be doing better? And make that operation more efficient. So maybe it's an alternative crop. Maybe it's changing the type of poplar that we're growing or what we're growing it for. And we're going to continue to keep the doors open, but it's going to be plan A is continue the poplar plantation.
And Dave Couch, quickly, in Arcata, it's got a lot of history behind it, the Arcata Marsh. Any changes envisioned in the future?
Well, we're always working on, we're trying to improve the design of our treatment marshes. We're, you know, some of them have been online since 1986, and what we're finding is that they, you know, they, like all equipment or all processes, they seem to have a lifespan. So we're working on new designs to make the treatment marshes better, and we have a couple of new treatment marshes that came online that have a new shaping at the bottom that should make them more efficient. And then we're also working on going to ultraviolet disinfection for our effluent, so we want to get away from the chlorination and dechlorination. And so those are kind of couple of our big areas.
All right. I want to thank you both for joining us today to talk about what happens at the other end of the sewer pipe. Dave Couch is a wastewater operator for Arcata. Todd Miller is the environmental management analyst at the Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission in Eugene, Springfield. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You bet.
Thank you.
Want to let our listeners know, in the Humboldt Bay and Mendocino County areas, that we'll be having a public meeting, a public reception, 7 o'clock on September 20th at the Eureka Theater in Eureka. You can learn about current and future JPR activities and question board members and staff of JPR Friday evening, September 20th at 7 at the Eureka Theater. Thank you for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. For Charlotte Duran, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Take care. Have a good day.
Welcome to As It Was, Tales from the State of Jefferson. Spain was the first country to explore the Pacific coast of North America in the 16th and 17th centuries. Its seamen contributed the first map of the coast between Panama and the northern boundary of California. The earliest expedition was led by Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo and continued after his death by his chief pilot, Bartolomé Ferrelo, who named Cape Mendocino in Northern California. He sailed farther north, perhaps in 1543, reaching 42.5 degrees north latitude, just shy of today's Port Orford, Oregon. In 1579, the English privateer, Sir Francis Drake, sailed even farther north in a futile search for a passage to the Atlantic. In 1602, the Spanish viceroy in Mexico City sent Sebastian Vizcaino on an expedition to locate safe harbors in California for Spanish galleons returning to Mexico from the Philippines. The log of one of Vizcaino's ship commanders, Martin de Aguilar, contains one of the first written descriptions of the Oregon coast. He named Cape Blanco in 1603 after the chalky appearance of the headland. Some say his ship, the Tres Reyes, may have reached the latitude of present-day Cuspe, Oregon. Today's episode of As It was written by Kernan Turner and produced by Raymond Scully. I'm Shirley Patton. As It Was is a co-production of JPR and the Southern Oregon Historical Society. To share stories or to learn more about the series, visit asitwas.org.